Public hearing only.
Right.
Okay, it's past the appointed time. We'll open the House Committee on Healthcare for Monday, May 16th, 2011. As the first order of business, which we always have first, is to rearrange the schedule. So we'll do that now so everyone can be confused. So today we're going to, on the bottom, if you're following on the agenda, we're going to do the public hearings at the bottom first. Number one will be 493, followed by 787, followed by 201, followed by, at the top, 86, and then 89. So if that helps you schedule your coffee break or something, you've got it. So first order of business, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 493A, and we are graced by a visit from Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Representative. May I please bring my constituent, Diane?
Yes.
With me? Thank you very much.
Are you Diane?
I am.
Okay. You're on my list anyway, so.
Co-Chair Thompson, committee members, thank you so much for scheduling this bill today. I'm Senator Suzanne Bonamici, and I represent Senate District 17. I'm thankful that you had scheduled a hearing on this bill today. As members of this committee, you certainly have heard, I'm sure, and know about the benefits of early detection of breast cancer. You've likely heard many times that proper screening increases survival rates and that early detection saves lives. I happen to be the daughter of a breast cancer survivor, and I have a heightened awareness of this issue. I've attended many Komen Foundation survivors brunches and have seen the numbers of survivors of all ages. Senate Bill 493A addresses the need for high-quality clinical breast exams that will lead to early detection and ultimately save lives. Clinical breast exams are a component of current breast cancer screening. Typically, they're performed as part of a woman's regular medical checkup. Now, you're going to hear from my constituent, Diane Pulser, with her story, and I want to applaud her for taking her experience and working on this bill to do something constructive that will help others who are facing breast cancer. You also should have before you some testimony from Dr. Maureen Philippek. She's a practicing radiologist who explains that Diane's story is not unique. Dr. Elizabeth Steiner has also been working with us. I know she has written testimony on its way. I don't believe you've received that yet, but we'll get that into you. From our conversations with experts, and we've been working throughout the interim on this issue, from our conversations with experts and from research, we learned that some practitioners who do clinical breast exams simply don't have training in current and more effective methods. There's an example from the Journal for Nurse Practitioners that talks about, despite the recommended vertical strip method, many practitioners are still using older concentric circle or radial spokes methods of conducting clinical breast exams. Now, when we started with this bill, we had a requirement in our original bill that anyone who is conducting clinical breast exams have, as part of their continuing medical education requirement, training in this current updated type of conducting clinical breast exams. However, when we had that bill drafted, we were not aware that there were several other mandatory continuing medical education bills that were proposed as well, and it became an issue of where to draw the line in terms of mandatory requirements for continuing medical education. So we now have what is designed to be a continuation of this important discussion by creating this task force to study how, when, and where to improve instruction in effective methods of clinical breast exams. Dr. Steiner is an expert in this issue, and she'll be submitting testimony about her commitment to continue working on this issue. We had talked about moving the training requirement perhaps upstream to the medical school level. What we'd like to do is continue our discussion formally and have a report back to the Legislative Assembly no later than the 2013 session. Again, this is very important work that we believe will save lives, and I want to thank you again for having this hearing, and I look forward to answering questions, but I would really like you to hear Diane's story as well. Thank you, Co-Chair Thompson.
If you have the time, I think we'll go on to her testimony and then do...
I do have the time to wait.
Okay.
I'd like you to...
Thank
hear.
You.
Sorry, thank you.
Please.
Thank you, Senator Bonamici. Thank you, Representatives, for having me here today to tell my story. I am a breast cancer survivor. I was diagnosed in the summer of 2008 after...
Could you identify yourself, please, for the record?
Yes,
I do it all the time.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Diane Pulser, for the record. I'm a breast cancer survivor, and I was diagnosed with breast cancer in the summer of 2008 after a routine gynecological exam. My gynecologist found a lump in my right breast. Unfortunately, my internist, I had pointed out that same lump to my internist an entire year before that, so the summer of 2007, at just a routine physical. He told me at that point in time that this lump was in fact a rib and to not worry about it. So I wanted to be an optimist, and you want to believe what your internist has to say, and so I believed him. I did say, are you sure we don't want to get an MRI or some other form of test? And he responded to me that that was overkill. So after my delayed diagnosis of 2008, I had two young children, still do at the time, a 4-year-old and a 14-year-old, two daughters, and I decided to have the most aggressive treatment possible. So I had a bilateral mastectomy, I had chemotherapy, 10 rounds of chemotherapy, and 33 days of radiation. The good news is I'm 3 years out, cancer-free. Thank you. But I fervently believe that perhaps some of that treatment could have been avoided had my diagnosis been a year earlier, had the internist been trained properly in clinical breast exams. I now know from working with Dr. Filipek and Dr. Steiner, who is an expert in the field at OHSU, I now know that once a patient points out a palpable lump to a practitioner, that practitioner should send the patient for immediate medical imaging. And that really is the standard of care. And had my internist been properly trained in clinical breast exams, that would have and should have been the result. Unfortunately, again, my story, I'm not an anomaly. If you read Dr. Filipek's testimony and you hear from Dr. Steiner, I am one of many, many women out there in the state of Oregon who have a delayed diagnosis. There are many wonderful practitioners in this state, and I have no doubt that my practitioner had all the right motives. He just wasn't properly trained. And really, my motivation here today in speaking to you and having this bill, it was Dr. Filipek's idea, and she came to me and said, would you tell your story? And I said, of course I'll tell my story. If I can help other women in the state of Oregon by developing a task force to help prevent what happened to me happening to another woman, I'd be happy to help in any way I can. I've volunteered many years, even before I was diagnosed with breast cancer, with my daughters at Race for the Cure. My aunt had breast cancer. It was an issue that was near and dear to my heart. And I remember as a cheerleader on the Race for the Cure finish line, one of the things we would chant to the survivors is, early detection is the best protection. And we all know that, and we just need to stand behind that. And I'd ask you today to support Senate Bill 493 in developing a task force to make sure that our practitioners who are out there practicing, that they properly know how to administer clinical breast exams. Thank you for allowing me this opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Parrish.
Thank you. Woman that we know and love, near and dear to us, just went through the same thing last week.
Wow, I'm really feedbacky today, aren't I? I'm going to vote for a task force bill, but what do you really want the bill to do? Because I'd rather pass that bill and not horse around with the task force bill, and I'd rather just get you to where you need to be. So what is the outcome that you're hoping out of a task force bill? Because, quite frankly, rather than task force bills, I'd like to see it right what we actually want and get it out the door so we don't waste a year doing this.
Do you want to respond?
Yeah. I think what we started with was a bill requiring clinical, CME, mandatory CME for physicians, not for all physicians because that would be overkill. But if you're going to be in the business of being a family practitioner or a gynecologist or an internist who performs clinical breast exams, you should know how to do them. And you should know what, there are pamphlets that are distributed by OHSU, I think I brought one today, on clinical breast exams. This is in their waiting rooms. My doctor didn't even follow what's the standard of care. And I think that, I don't think there was any ill intent. I just think that this is an issue where they should receive training, and I do understand that that's a slippery slope. Once you start mandating medical training, you know, once you start dictating how a doctor should practice, that is a slippery slope. But there are other areas where we do mandate on a state level the training that doctors need to perform before they're able to practice. And that's really where we started, and we were met with some resistance, and so we thought, well, let's make sure that what we want is really truly the best way to address this issue.
And Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlich, and Representative Parrish, I confirm everything that Diane explained about where we started and where we ended up. When we had the version of the bill that did require that as part of the existing continuing medical education for anyone who does clinical breast exams, certainly not, you know, a podiatrist or something, but somebody who does clinical breast exams, that as part of their existing continuing medical education requirement, they have this training in this updated, more effective methods of clinical breast exam. There was a concern not only because of, you know, where do you draw the line? We currently have a requirement for pain management, and I know Representative Greenlich perhaps knows the history of where that came from, but where do you draw the line in terms of what you require as part of that training? There was also the sort of thinking that that mandated education may not necessarily be the best approach in the sort of you can lead a horse to water, that sometimes if somebody's in a training seminar and they don't want to be there, they're not really paying attention and not really benefiting as much from it. So we're going to continue looking at where the most effective way is to implement this training requirement, and it may be at the level before the practitioners actually start practicing when they're going through their medical training. And Dr. Steiner's very committed to helping us do an assessment of where the needs are and the best way to address it. And Co-Chair Greenlich and Co-Chair Thompson and committee, I also wanted to explain, just to give sort of credit to Diane. Diane happens to be an attorney. I've known her for a long time. And as you know, I also have a law degree. And so I when she told me your story, I said, did you sue your doctor? And she said, no, I didn't, because that's not constructive. She said she wanted to do something constructive and work with the system to prevent this from happening to other women, and I really applaud her for that. Thank you.
Representative Greenlich.
Senator Bonamici, you can help me on this. I'm usually not confused, but I feel a little confused today. In the 2007
session... We can
vote
on that.
No, wait a minute. I may be confused. I don't usually think I'm confused.
better. Some of us can agree with that for ourselves.
In the 2007 session, we had all the same testimony with Dr. Steiner leading the way, as I remember, about the problem of not having proper breast exams and how OHSU had developed them and was training them. And the barrier at that time was that insurance companies wouldn't pay for the more expensive exam. So didn't we pass a bill requiring insurance companies to pay for the...
Co-Chair Greenlich, Co-Chair Thompson, committee members, there was a bill that was passed, and I believe it had to do with coding, and I think it was perhaps even before that. I think it was in 2005. House Bill 2498 in 2005 deals with insurance coverage for clinical breast exams. So
dealing with the coverage of the more complex exam, because
I believe that's correct.
And that was viewed as the problem, was that people weren't doing this exam because they weren't getting paid for the extra cost for doing a 20-minute to 25-minute exam. If done properly. So it turned out that wasn't the barrier, I take it. Is that?
Co-Chair Greenlich and Co-Chair Thompson, I believe that's part of the problem, and in our discussions over the interim, there were discussions about how those exams are coded, and maybe that needs to be clarified, but this is actually a separate issue. I don't believe that
Well,
Diane,
it's the same issue. It's that these exams aren't getting done is the issue.
I don't believe that Diane's physician had a coding problem. I think it was a lack of education problem.
Anyone else?
I wish I were convinced this would solve the problem, Mr. Chair. I think that's I think it is a problem, making sure. The fusion of innovation is very complex and in medicine, and I can understand why somebody isn't going to do something if they're not getting paid for it. Now they're getting paid for it, so the question is, how do we get them to do it again? And the answer is having a task force. I think I worry about it, about this as being a strong enough answer to the question of how we get that diffusion of innovation down into the clinic.
Representative Kinnemer.
Just kind of on a personal note, this month makes 13 years since my wife passed away, from the first wife, from the complications of breast cancer. in her case, the mammogram picked it up, but it was very small and it already progressed substantially. And the interesting thing is, if she were diagnosed today, she probably would survive. So we're making some treatment successes, but we have a long ways to go. And very sorry about what was clearly a clinical mistake.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of following on what Representative Greenwood was saying, I don't know if making a task force really fixes the problem. I mean, I have a son right now. I mean, not to diffuse breast cancer at all, but he's been getting strep throat. His tonsils are huge. They won't take out his tonsils. Well, if he gets strep throat one more time. And that's the thing I see. You walk in with a lump, and the doctor says, it's probably not worried, just a rib. It's people that we're dealing with. So when you have different doctors with different personalities that look at things and see things differently, and it's raising the awareness, I think, is a big thing. And I don't know if the task force really is going to raise the awareness for them to take this more seriously or how we go about raising that awareness. And Senator, if either one of you would like to make a comment on that. But I think that's what we're after, is raising the awareness so people take this more seriously.
Co-Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson and Representative Widener and committee members, I agree that raising awareness is very important. It's also important to make sure that we're getting the appropriate training to the practitioners at the appropriate time. And that's what the group is committed to working on and coming back soon. And I agree that the task force is not going to solve the problem, but hopefully the task force can come up with the solution that will result in the appropriate training being provided at the time that will actually result in earlier diagnoses. Did you want to respond to that as well?
If I could. I think the task force would be extremely helpful in at least allowing the people who brought this issue to Senator Bonamici to continue to study it, because often if Dr. Steiner, for instance, can go to OHSU and say, I've been appointed to this task force, she can continue on an easier basis to study this issue. When we first talked to Senator Bonamici...
Don't stop her from doing anything.
Well, when we talked to Senator Bonamici about how we can move this bill forward, it was... met with some resistance from the OMA, from the Oregon Nurses Association, even from OHSU, because there wasn't enough sort of momentum behind it. I think that a task force would at least allow professionals like Dr. Steiner, like Dr. Filipek, whoever else is appointed to the task force, to have a report with a recommendation. Here's the issue. This time we really mean it. Can you please pass a bill which would, at some level, require the doctors to do what they're supposed to do? And I certainly hear from Representative Widener that, you can legislate across the board how to do, how to practice medicine. However, in this instance, it seems like there is an easy way to at least have standards that are legislated that could avoid serious issues like breast cancer, because it really is an epidemic. In the state of Oregon, it's 1 in 7 or 1 in 8. And every time you turn around, there's a friend, mother, sister in the state of Oregon that's been diagnosed with breast cancer.
Very briefly, I lost a friend this weekend from breast cancer who was an athlete, ate organic food, very healthy, thin, low body fat, and her doctor didn't think to treat her the same way that, and she didn't think to get the same kind of tests that somebody else might have, because she thought of herself as healthy and immune and not there. So I think it's important that we do whatever we can to make sure that people are getting the right screening and the best treatment, and that we educate our health practitioners. So if this is, maybe this isn't everything we want, and I understand that, but if this gets us a little bit closer, then I'm glad to support it.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Wyden.
Just brief follow-up. I'm just wondering how we get about this, because I think sometimes I think mothers are about the best doctors, because my wife knows what's going on with our kids more than anything. And I wonder if we need to be raising awareness, which I guess the task force would do that, but for people looking out for themselves.
So you like the task force too, huh?
Well, I sometimes have issues with task force because we're not really doing it, but how do you get people to start looking out for themselves rather than having somebody else look out for them, because doctors are only humans as well, and I think that's what you ran into in your situation, if I'm wrong, is this was just another doctor that was there, and he thought it was something else other than what it was, and that's where you did the right, well, actually you did the right thing later on, but at that point should have said, you know, I would like to have somebody else look at this, or at that point. So how do we get people standing up for themselves? I think that's the bigger thing, because we walk in trusting a doctor thinking they know it all, and they don't. They're only human, just like us.
Representative Parrish, you're taking us out here.
Like I said, I'm going to vote for a task force, for this particular task force bill. I'm not a big task force bill fan either, because they just wind up in my reports to the legislative file in my inbox. When you do the task force piece, I would also ask and urge that you consider that for the handful of men. If you're having problems as a woman with, you know, clear parts that need examining, I can't imagine what it's like for the handful of men who wind up with breast tissue cancer as well, who probably aren't considered in this process. We've known folks who that's affected. And a lot of times that gets kind of slid under the table in this conversation, as we think that, you know, bills about women's health. Well, you know, there aren't, this one feels like a women's health, but there are men who are affected by this as well. So I hope your task force pays attention to that as well, because I have a feeling that their access to care is even more challenging than ours.
So noted.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 493A and open the public. Do we have the people we want to?
Well, you can get started. Okay. Okay. No, we'll get them.
We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 787A. And I will call John DiLorenzo, Bob Willing, Joe Bell.
Did you get Andrew?
Oh.
John DiLorenzo.
Andrew, you're the third one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 787A requires health benefit plans to provide coverage of telemedical health services provided in connection with the treatment of diabetes that meets certain criteria if the health services is otherwise covered by a health benefit plan. This left the Senate floor with 29 ayes and one excuse.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner with the law firm of Davis Wright Germain, and I'm here today on behalf of my former client, Harold Schnitzer, and one of his companies, ADS Investments, in support of Senate Bill 787A. Mr. Schnitzer passed away on April 27th, 2 days after this legislation, which he championed, passed the Senate by a vote of 29-0. We were grateful that he knew of this before his passing. He was very excited about the possibilities. Most of you knew Harold Schnitzer as a businessman and a philanthropist. He was also a diabetic who lived with the disease for nearly 50 years, most of his adult life. The Harold Schnitzer Diabetes Health Center, established in 2007, has been the beneficiary of a $5.6 million donation by Harold and Arlene Schnitzer's private foundation to help others afflicted with diabetes. The medical community has been searching for a cure for diabetes for decades. Finding a cure will take decades more. In the meantime, the disease affects over 200,000 Oregonians and will only increase over time. we must do a better job of managing it so that those who suffer from it can live productive lives, and so our state can avoid the catastrophic costs which it will otherwise incur if we do nothing during the interim. Last March, Governor Kitzhaber gave his State of the State address at the Portland City Club. With regard to health care, he said, quote, 10% of the population drives 70% of all health care costs, the vast majority of which are due to chronic conditions. If we can redirect a portion of the current resources expended on chronic conditions to wellness and prevention, we can drastically reduce health care costs and dramatically improve the health of Oregonians. One analogy he used was that of an elderly woman who had a congestive heart condition. She does well as long as her apartment remains reasonably cool during the summer. However, if her home becomes overheated, it puts undue stress on her heart, which results in a trip to the emergency room. Medicare will pay $50,000 worth of services and the trip to the hospital, but won't pay $200 to purchase an air conditioner for her apartment. There is something wrong with that model. These observations relate to diabetes as well. It is a chronic condition that, if well managed, can be far less costly to the individual and to society. Management of the disease will prevent or slow its progression. Absent management, the disease will lead to far more costly medical complications and a compromising quality of life. There are current time-tested techniques that involve careful monitoring and ongoing interaction with the patient. Yet our reimbursement model has not kept up with the best ways that the medical profession can stay in touch with its patient base to ensure consistency and continuity of care. That is why Senate Bill 787A is necessary, to compensate physicians for delivering health care counsel that will help optimize the patient's adherence to a treatment plan and to modify the plan in light of symptoms and progression which this disease demands. In this arena, telemedicine is much more time efficient for both the professional and the patient, requiring less travel and time away from work and much greater efficiency. Senate Bill 787A expands the current definition of telemedical beyond video communication to include audio, voice over internet protocol, transmission of telemetry, and other technologies, which will allow the health professional to interact with the patient, a parent or guardian of the patient, or another health professional on the patient's behalf. The bill, which is meant to create a pilot project, limits this expansion to the treatment of diabetes if an insurance plan provides coverage for health service had it been provided in person. In addition, the bill removes a restriction found generally in ORS 743A.058 that the service must not duplicate or supplant another kind of health service that is available to the patient in person, and that the insurance plan need not reimburse a health professional who is not a covered provider under the plan. Senate Bill 787A makes those departures from the general telemedicine rule in case of diabetes treatment in recognition of the resources that are present at the OHSU Harold Schnitzer Diabetes Health Center. Representatives of the health industry have not only been consulted in framing this bill, they negotiated amendments with us on the Senate side. And I believe we currently have the support of Regents Blue Cross with respect to this matter. The center is facing an operating...
John, can I interrupt you just briefly?
Yes.
Where are you in your testimony?
I am just ready to conclude.
Okay, go ahead. We have to get Senator Morris Anderson on because we borrowed her from another committee, and I understand she is part of the body of the committee that can't be gone, and she is. So,
well, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Chair, if I may,
before I conclude, I was just going to introduce Dr. Ammon, so why don't I yield to Senator Morris Anderson,
okay,
and I'll introduce
that's
Dr.
fine.
Ammon.
Sorry about that, but
no,
get her back, there's no quorum, and some other committee is stranded on the rocks or something. So,
see, Senator Rack is here. I'd be pleased to offer her my seat.
Hello. Thank you, Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Thompson, and Green and Graham Senator Lori Monis Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. And I'm delighted to be here to talk about Senate Bill 787. I had the opportunity to actually tour the Diabetes Center at OHSU, the Harold Schnitzer Diabetes Health Center, and was most impressed with the work that they were doing. I think some of you were on that tour also with me. you know that telemedicine is a part of healthcare reform. It really is, and we have a long ways to go to make it a real part of it. And I view this piece of legislation as a pilot. It'll be a pilot that only OHSU, Harold Schnitzer Diabetes Health Center, will be using, and we will be able to determine from when they implement this the cost effectiveness of using telemedicine in the treatment of diabetes. I know it is in the best interest of the patient for sure, and I know it is for the staff. It's a chronic disease, and over 8% of the U.S. population has diabetes, and over 200,000 Oregonians have diabetes, with another 500,000 with pre-diabetes. 3 Oregonians die from diabetes each day. I really don't have much more to say. You do have my testimony, and I so thank you for allowing me to just put in a word in edgewise here.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. All right.
John, I guess you can have the microphone back.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, before I introduce Dr. Ammon, may we defer to Senator Atkinson, who's also here, with the chair's permission.
Are you on short time? I'm sorry you didn't identify that. You have to tell me that you don't. Okay.
Go on. Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Vice-Chair.
We've heard
Mr.
stories that most of the Senate is kind of on recess now because they're not moving any House bills, so we just thought you weren't in a hurry.
Now,
so.
What a nice way to open. No,
please proceed.
I will tell the you have rescued me from a PowerPoint presentation, so I am very happy to listen to all the other testimony. For the record, Jason Atkinson, State Senator for a large portion of Southern Oregon. Let me tell you a little bit about this bill historically that I think, at least for me, demonstrates a part of pride. A very good friend of mine outside of politics is one of the nation's leaders in mental health services. Absolutely brilliant person who Oregon Health Sciences snatched up out of their great wisdom. And he had developed this idea. He had kept a very active practice in the states that he had been on. He lives on airplanes back and forth. Katrina hits, and he had kept his license active in Louisiana, but he worked in Portland. And so during the aftermath of all things Hurricane Katrina-related, he saw all these people with a tremendous amount of need without a lot of money. And here he sat in Oregon with the best and the brightest, arguably one of the finest medical schools in the United States, certainly in the West Coast. And yet the need was in Louisiana. And so what he did is he set up this thing called telehealth, where we would actually deliver mental health services through Oregon Health Science University to Louisiana. And it worked great. And he and I were together one time, and he's telling me how this works, and he told me the patient load, and he told me all the savings, and he told me how people were served by it. And at that same session, rural Oregon was facing tremendous cuts in what we call the ONC counties. And as you know, in the ONC county world, the first things that are cut are mental health services, then sheriffs, then jails, to be blunt.
The libraries come first.
And then libraries, you're right, Co-Chair. Sorry, yeah, you're correct. Anyway, so I wrote a bill that would allow the same practice to happen from Oregon Health Sciences that was happening to Louisiana to ONC counties. And believe it or not, it came to Salem and hit a snag. And it hit a snag, and I think, if I recall correctly, it took us 3 sessions to actually get it through. And we got it through, and we went through tremendous birth pains to get it, and now it works fabulously. And this last summer, early fall, I was contacted by a good friend of mine, Mr. DiLorenzo, who said, "Weren't you involved in some healthcare telemedicine thing?" And we started talking about the idea of would that still apply to diabetes, and it made perfect sense. It just made perfect sense. And so I bring to you not only support of the bill, but also a tremendous opportunity, I think, for our medical school, Oregon Health Sciences, to be used all around the state. And I think that is just brilliant. I think people are going to be able to be served by it. I think the thing makes cash flow sense now, as I'm sure Mr. DiLorenzo has explained to you. Now this pays for itself. and as essentially the check writers for a portion of that medical school's budget, it behooves us to set policy that pays for itself. I think this is just fantastic. I'm glad to see how hard Mr. DiLorenzo has worked to make sure that a wide cross-section of people in the industry, both insurance and healthcare related, have built a coalition, and I'm just delighted and very proud to support it. So, Mr. Co-Chair, I'd be delighted to answer any questions, but that's actually the history of it. This thing goes all the way back to Katrina and Louisiana, and now comes to you helping people with diabetes needs in Oregon.
Thank you. Yes. Do you want to introduce Andrew?
And I'm going to go back to committee then if you're done with me. I might take the long route. It is a PowerPoint, but I'll be right back.
Don't say we didn't give you an opportunity. So,
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, we are grateful to both Senator Montes Anderson and Senator Atkinson for having the interest that they've shown in this bill and having shepherded it through the Senate. At this point, I would like to take the opportunity to introduce the director of the center, Dr. Andrew Ammon. Oregon is fortunate to have Dr. Ammon at the Oregon Health Sciences Center. He is one of the nation's top endocrinologists. He has devoted his career to helping manage this dreadful disease, and he will spend a few moments discussing the opportunities which reimbursement for use of telemedical technologies will present to the center, to its patients, and to Oregonians who live in the rural and underserved corners of our state.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Greenlich and Co-Chair Thompson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrew Ammon. As stated, I'm director of the Harold Snitzer Diabetes Center, the West Coast's only combined comprehensive pediatric and adult diabetes center, in one of only about 10 such centers in the country, where endocrinologists focus solely on evaluating, preventing, and treating patients with diabetes. In a general endocrinology practice, diabetes patients represent about the most labor-intensive aspect of that practice over the duration of the patient-physician relationship. In our practice, that's all we do within the center is to provide state-of-the-art care, particularly for complex cases. Beyond serving our own patients in the center, our mission is also to reach out to improve the quality of diabetes care through patient education, advocacy for diabetes care reform, provider education, and more effective methods of consultation for practitioners throughout our region and state. With a few examples, I hope to illustrate how Senate Bill 787A will help us deliver health care in a more timely basis in a more cost-efficient manner. So Emily is a young woman who has type 1 diabetes for 16 years. She's had no insurance nor financial resources to manage her diabetes optimally. She recently married and just found out that she is pregnant. She must monitor her glucose 7 or more times a day. She must incorporate new dietary approaches, new glucose goals, new insulin regimens with up to 7 injections daily. Her health and that of her baby depends on her success. She lives 90 miles away and cannot come in on a regular basis. Robert just had a kidney transplant that was brought on by his type 2 diabetes. As is common, his blood glucose rose dramatically following his surgery and the associated anti-rejection medication. He was started on 4 injections daily of insulin in the hospital and is discharged with the task of managing his blood glucose to preserve the transplant and to reduce the risk of infection that are inherent in surgeries for people with diabetes and then further compounded by the anti-rejection medications. A third case is Amy, a 9-year-old girl who was just admitted to the hospital after being ill for several weeks with weight loss, fatigue, and frequent urination. She's diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and the family is told that she will require at least 4 injections of insulin daily to survive. Her parents are overwhelmed by the diagnosis and what it means for Amy and the whole family. After just 2 days in the hospital, they will be going home trying to absorb all the information they received during the brief, stressful introduction to a lifelong illness. How will they manage to get through this frightening transition? And finally, Jeremy is a 29-year-old professional who's lived with type 1 diabetes for 16 years. He's worked hard to control his disease with frequent glucose monitoring and 4 injections a day. He remains very active, running at least 5 miles daily. Unfortunately, he's been experiencing severe hypoglycemic episodes where he passed out on several occasions and actually experienced a seizure on at least one occasion. The stressor that really precipitated his presentation to our practice was that his wife was suddenly fearful of leaving him alone with their newborn baby. In order to continue good glucose control but avoid the severe low blood sugars, he's being placed on a computerized insulin pump. He must learn how to adjust three different settings in the pump and use its new capabilities to adjust the exercise and other factors that predispose to severe hypoglycemia or low blood sugar. I could present you with numerous other scenarios that demonstrate a therapeutic problem we experience in our diabetes practice multiple times each day. In all these cases, the choices become having the patient come in frequently, up to every week, or having them transmit detailed glucose records to us that we can review and clarify with them by telephone, always with the goal of improving glucose control safely, meaning such that we don't have severe hypoglycemia. Presently, we ask many patients to send in results weekly, sometimes more often. These are only four cases. As you've heard, there's about 26 million people in the United States with diabetes and over 200,000 Oregonians with diabetes. Type 1 diabetes requires intensive insulin regimens at all times to prevent serious acute and chronic complications, which become more costly as the disease progresses. Type 2 diabetes is a progressive disease that often requires insulin therapy later in life and at critical times, as during acute illness or following surgery. This is complex therapy where evidence indicates that the benefits are very profound but are mitigated by the adverse effects of hypoglycemia created by insulin, generally considered a very high-risk medication. The usual measure of glucose control over time is a blood test called the hemoglobin A1C. In people with diabetes or without diabetes or prediabetes, the hemoglobin A1C will be less than 5.7%. In other words, normal is less than 5.7%. The goal for those with diabetes under treatment is less than 7%. Several years ago, Kaiser Permanente Northwest published a review of the practices of their physicians in advancing medical therapy in patients with type 2 diabetes to maintain that goal of under 7%. What they found was that the average point at which physicians changed patients to insulin after they weren't controlled with pills was not the 7% as they had hoped, not even 7.5, 8, or 8.5%, but rather the average time at which the patients were advanced in therapy was 9.6%, meaning those individual patients were subjected to severe hyperglycemia for prolonged periods of time, usually 5 to 10 years, before they were advanced to the appropriate therapy to try and get their glucose to the protective levels. Why did this happen? It was really the fear of insulin treatment for both patients and for physicians. It is complex and requires systematic expert support to implement safe and effective therapy, particularly with advanced regimens such as we see with multiple insulin doses. Time for patient communication is critical. Physical office visits are not timely, and they are costly in terms of time and money for both parties. More than in any other disease, patients with diabetes are expected to act as their own practitioner most of the time. Those on intensive insulin regimens are asked to test the blood glucose 4 or more times daily, recognize the relationship between their blood glucose, their insulin doses, and daily occurrences such as illness, psychological stress, exercise, new foods, emotional or hormonal changes, and many more. Some of them are able to do quite well when they have received adequate diabetes education and they've adjusted to their routines and the typical deviations thereof. However, they often need added expert assistance when new therapies or new challenges arise as their bodies react and adapt to the changing situation. The most effective and efficient method of accomplishing this is with transmission of glucose data paired with specific person-to-person clarification and professional guidance. The benefit of using frequently sampled glucose readings to guide insulin therapy to identify a suboptimal control in those who receive insulin therapy is really indisputable. There is significant literature of the benefit of telemedicine of various types for those for improving diabetes care. For example, a recent follow-up of the telemedicine study that was conducted by another combined center, the Naomi Berry Diabetes Center in New York, showed that one of the best predictors of success was the downloading of glucose values reviewed by patients and the provider. Another report this year from Albert Einstein in New York showed that telephonic intervention improved diabetes control and improved adherence to medications for ethnically diverse urban adults. Most recently, a study involving those with type 1 diabetes found that relatively frequent communications with patients by telephone with reduced clinic visits was more effective than every three-month visits in controlling diabetes. As we look for new ways to deliver health services, I believe the slight modifications of our state definition for telemedicine represent a cost-effective, simple step to improve intensive diabetes care. We believe a carefully planned cooperative pilot with health insurers would serve to clarify and document this very focused but important intervention. The information could identify any cost benefits and best practices that could lead to further changes in healthcare delivery to benefit all of those in our state, perhaps applicable to other diseases as well over time. There is no intention on our part to reflect on the broader definitions and applications of telemedicine where video interaction is very important. This represents a specific application that can benefit those with complicated diabetes. Thank you.
Any questions? Attorney Greenlee.
Yes, hi, Dr. Harmon. Thank you for coming. A while back, I was Deputy Director of the Evidence-Based Practice Center at OHSU and co-PI of a study looking at the cost-effectiveness of telemedicine generally. That was about 10 years ago, so the field has changed a lot. But one of the issues that talked about in that study looking at the evidence was that it could be cost effective except in the case where it took existing medical expenses and added another layer of expense rather than replace the layer of expense. In this sense, do you see the ability to collect at the center for services, which might be nice to the budget of the center, adding or subtracting from the overall cost of diabetes care in the state?
Yes, Representative Greenlick. The
softball.
Okay. Huh? Is it softball? Okay, I'll take it. I think that's what's important about this being a pilot is that we're going to identify where you actually have cost savings, where you just improve care at a reasonable cost, and where it's important in terms of separation from the patient by distance and some other factors. My impression is that, especially from this most recent trial, is that you could probably, you might do this in a even trade-off in terms of cost, for instance. You might have more frequent contact at a lower cost, but what you're going to do that's not considered in those costs are the cost of time away from work, the travel, and the extra administrative costs of handling things in the clinic and so forth. And that's where I think we'll see that there's some advantage. What we're also probably going to see is that we're going to find patients who don't come back for their every three-month visit because of distance and other factors, and suddenly we're going to have them better captured in communication so that I think we'll improve outcomes in that regard. Clearly, it doesn't take a long intervention and to make a difference in these particular set of patients. These are not for all patients. It's not going for things that are less intensive in origin or for things that are less risky compared to insulin therapy. But I think that it'll end up being something that is practical for the insurance companies, and they will be involved in determining how we look at this.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Doherty.
Sir, I'm assuming that in some of the more rural areas that endocrinologists are not plentiful.
Exactly. There's many parts of Representative Doherty. There are many parts of Oregon where they don't have an endocrinologist, have to drive a long way.
Right.
We even have patients that drive, a couple hundred miles to see us, which is kind of crazy.
A follow-up.
And yes. I think part of this, and I appreciate the center because I'm diabetic, and I'm lucky because I live in Portland, and I have lots of places that I can go. I've got good insurance, and so I think it's very good. But to have this sort of a center that is world-class, to be able to have people access this that live in the rural areas, I think is admirable. So it's a very, very good. It's a wonderful center, and I think it's very good for rural Oregon and rural health in Oregon, because this is going to be the disease, if it isn't already the disease. So, and it's something that is lifelong. It doesn't go away. It diminishes, but does not go away.
So. Yes, for these more complex cases, mm-hmm. we would imagine making an initial contact one way or another with the patient through their physician or in a direct visit, mm-hmm. but then subsequent visits would be replaced by a lot of telephone calls to really safely get them in control. And we're working on it on a separate method for them to actually download the information and send it to us that could then also be applied to a broader base later.
Representative Parrish?
Thank you. Yeah, this is fascinating to me. In fact, I had a gentleman come to my office, a constituent, on a different issue, but is graduating in 2 weeks from OHSU with a doctorate in, like, a nurse practitioner with psychiatric nursing, doing just this, going to set up his whole practice around this notion of putting up big screen TVs or whatever somewhere and trying to do psychiatric care for rural communities is a big focus, but from an office in Tualatin. And I just have to think that as technology changes, this is the path. I mean, I get a lot of flack because I walk around with my laptop all day and I get a lot of work done. And, you know, generationally, it is a different way. And I think when you're talking about, the prevalence of diabetes hitting young children, this is a big way for them to communicate. They understand this. I think it makes a lot of sense for them. And I'm a total supporter. I'm curious how many younger patients and what the reaction is for the work that you are doing, you know, generationally, because I think this is something that could help a younger generation really dial into their healthcare because it's in a format that they understand.
Yes, Representative Parrish. What I would propose is that that's not specifically what we're asking for here, and yet it's likely to be part of it because we've already requested that in a grant that we have in for a different way of approaching working with primary care and enhancing the kinds of services they have available. That in clearly with almost everybody, but particularly younger people, we're seeing this change in how they communicate. Whether it's cell phones or smartphones, which will probably be the main one because so many people have that when they don't have even a desktop computer, mm-hmm. that we think that that's how we're going to do a lot of communication to reinforce things. That will be sort of a corollary to this. It's not specifically what this is aimed at, but it's the spirit in which we're doing this.
I'd follow up.
Please.
I just think the cost and delivery, when you can have that kind of rapid interaction, and like I said, I'm never without either a phone or laptop, but it is huge. And so I want to, I'm going to lend my full support because I think it's fascinating the work that you're doing, and particularly as it does relate to folks who are having, this is hitting young people. I can't wait to see how this comes out. So thank you guys for bringing this forward.
Okay, thank you. We have three more panel members. Bob Dumig, Joe Bell, and John Powell, please.
Joe's going to hang in the background in case I run into some tough questions,
yeah.
And then she'll come up. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Dumig. I'm testifying today as the chair of the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. It's the mission of the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon to advance telehealth knowledge, practice, and policy in Oregon, and we favor the consideration of reimbursement for services delivered in modalities different than the two-way video that we're very familiar with, including such ways as email and telemonitoring. The management of chronic diseases is a huge priority in most legislation regarding health care reform, and the use of technology has shown much promise. We are, however, remaining neutral today on this bill. The Telehealth Alliance created at the request of Senator Mona Sanderson a couple years ago the reimbursement work group. And out of the year-long work of that group, we came up with Senate Bill 24 for the last session. That work group is made up of providers, payers, and other interested folks in telehealth. It was our inability to get consensus amongst that group that is keeping us neutral today. The concerns that that people within the organization have is that we do favor the research that is to be required by the diabetes centers. Good outcome information will benefit both providers and payers. And as we consider expansion to other telemedicine services in Oregon, we do have our concerns on the construction of a study methodology for this particular reimbursement method. We have some concerns on the timeline for the pilot. We acknowledge that outcome studies are longitudinal in nature. However, given the rapid pace of telemedicine development and deployment, we'd like to have some type of a report that could come back both to the legislature and to those that are interested in telehealth policy, because the speed by which these, again, telemedicine is moving, we want to be able to keep up with any of the changes that may happen. Baseline information. At this point, we're unsure exactly how the clients would actually benefit from this bill and reimbursement. The bill will not be impact Medicare, Medicaid, or uninsured clients. The bill, the center has indicated they have a large number of these clients that are uninsured, and so we believe making sure that we are on a solid baseline will be important. And, of course, figuring out how a study could be clearly funded with, again, those outlines for both the legislature and those others that are involved. Tao does believe that all the policies and rules for telemedicine, both at the state and federal levels, are and will continue to change rapidly as telemedicine becomes integrated into healthcare reform. It is important that these policies are changed based on sound data and do not create added barriers to providers or payers. Tao has worked hard to assure that all those involved in telemedicine, the payers, providers, and policymakers, are included in the decision-making processes regarding the policies that govern its use. It is Tao's goal that telemedicine grow and flourish and as it has in other states, and creating an environment that is free of policy barriers and that invites competition is a path toward achieving that goal. Thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you.
John? Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. As was presented by Mr. DiLorenzo, we've been part of the negotiations that have gone on in this bill for some time and reached an agreement to support the bill as it is before you today. And some of the amendments that we had proposed and were agreed to include the fact that this must be patient-specific, and one of our concerns was you could have webinars for every provider in the country and bill for that, and that was not their intent, and they agreed to those amendments. So we've tried to narrow the scope to treating patients and the welfare of patients with this terrible disease. So we are confident that we can include other groups as we go forward in designing the study that will be reported back, and we do intend to bring information back to the legislature on this subject. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Greenlee?
John, the extent to which your coverage includes in-network and out-of-network coverage, I assume you have that in some of your policies.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlech, the difference is usually in the amount that's paid.
But you do have differences. Would in this experiment, would you see the clinic as an in-network provider in terms of co-insurance and things for that?
Co-Chair Greenlech, yes, we do have a contract with at least the major institution in Oregon, OHSU.
So the assumption would be that if the patient had a $20 copay for a doctor office visit and they had that in telemedicine, they would have their $20 copay for the telemedicine visit?
Mr. Chair, the bill allows for the provisions of the policy to govern, which would include copays. Yes.
That's what I was checking.
Yes.
Anyone else? Well, thank you both. Okay. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 787A, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 787A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 787A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Greenlech has moved Senate Bill 787 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Did you get that number right?
Well, I don't know. It's Senate Bill 787 moved to the floor. So I may not have, since I'm having trouble with that number today. Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be very interested to support this bill. I'd be very interested in a consideration during the interim of the subject of telemedicine more generally. And this bill is very narrow. There are probably some good reasons for that. But I wonder, I'd be interested in knowing how close we are to opening this up.
Yes,
and to say
I agree.
If there's not, maybe continuing to keep that provision that if there is somebody who can see you in person, mm-hmm. you don't qualify necessarily for reimbursement. But if there's not, why would we restrict this just to diabetes? And why would we restrict it just to OHSU? And I understand the political compromises that went into crafting this bill, but as a subject for this committee to perhaps become proactive on during the interim,
from my perspective, which doesn't matter a whole lot, but having visited the center, one of my interests is in doing exactly that. I'm wondering why we don't have a center like this for asthma, which is very very poorly treated in rural Oregon for lack of practitioners. Maybe hypertension, maybe even obesity. But if we can have one center that we have in Oregon recognized for its excellence that particularly rural Oregon can bounce off of where specialists don't exist, I think we can move medicine forward quite economically. But my understanding on this particular bill was it is a test platform in a disease state that is very important, and it will give us a chance to do exactly what you ask.
It will be interesting to have an update on the science, because it was very clear that some forms of telemedicine really saved costs in
better
care,
yeah.
and some forms simply added to the cost without changing outcomes. But as I say, that was at least 10 years ago, so I think things have changed a lot.
I'd like to be involved in that conversation, too. I think one of the considerations there is this notion, though, of, if we're going to look at alternative communication forms with providers, that there is some sense on their end that, if they start stepping out of that box, that they're not going to get, smacked with a lawsuit because, I've got three kids. Two of them come down with strep throat. I wanted to send her a text message and say, hey, the third one's throat looks awful, too. Do I have to really come back in and just, can you just send over my prescription? How does she get billed for that, or what's the risk for her to do that? And those have been legitimate conversations at our house about how do we do, how do you do that, and how does she get covered for that? So I would love to be involved in that conversation as well. So I think that's one of the concerns providers have about this.
Anyone else? Just as an aside, I had a meeting a couple of weeks ago with an outfit in Denver, totally not capital business, but talking about telemedicine, that is offering services to a number of states in pharmacy. And they provide staff pharmacy, staffing pharmacies in hospitals at night from Denver. Obviously, the dispensing is done at the hospital level, but the pharmacy expertise is coming from Denver over a multi-state level, allowing small regional hospitals not to have to maintain a pharmacist on site at night. And it's a little scary, but it's a little, at the same time, hey, this thing might actually work. It's a direction rather than the whole answer. But anything else? Representative Widener.
Mr. Chair, on behalf of Representative Schaffler, there's a time to talk and there's a time to vote, and it's time to vote.
Are you calling for the question?
He's channeling.
What did you say about cutting down trees?
We can cut gravel or mine gravel and cut trees in this bill as well. Let's do it.
Would you please do us the honor of calling the roll?
Representative Doherty.
Yes.
Representative Parrish.
Yes.
Representative Boyle.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cannon.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cannon.
Aye.
Chair
Greenlee?
Aye.
Chair Thompson?
Aye. And it looks like the ayes have it. Representative Greenlee, would you like to carry this bill?
I'd love to.
Okay, that is done. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 787A. I think I got the number right that time. Okay. Is Bates going to be here?
He wasn't in the room.
Okay, next we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 201A. And we have a list of guests or something here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 201A authorizes the Oregon Health Authority to approve transfer of 500 or more enrollees from one prepaid managed care health service organization to another under specified circumstances. This declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal statement that just provides an explanation. And it basically is saying that this has minimal expenditure on the health authority. This left the Senate floor with 30 ayes.
Okay. We're going to call our first panel. I understand Dr. Senator Bates will be here, and he's on short notice somewhere else. So while we're finding him, would Dr. Bradine, Judy Moore Peterson, and Charlene Matthew please come forward? And we will probably end up interrupting you when Dr. Bates gets here because I think we're borrowing him from something else. So
Senate Health.
Okay. It's very important today because some of the committees are running right at quorum. So we take someone away from a committee, the committee's not functioning until we get them back. So that's, you please state your name and begin.
Co-Chair Greenlee, Co-Chair Thompson, and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me this opportunity today. My name is Dr. Risa Bradine. I'm a pediatrician with Metropolitan Pediatrics in Portland, and I practiced for 20 years. I'm also medical director for Children's Health Alliance, which is an association of 125 pediatricians practicing from Salem metro area and Southwest Washington. I am testifying in support of this bill. This bill does two things. When patients enroll in Oregon Health Plan, and then the preferred delivery system is a managed care plan, then they are asked to choose a managed care plan. If they're unable to, one's chosen for them. And then they have 30 days to change plans if that wasn't the right plan for them. What we are asking is that ability to change your plan be once during their entire enrollment period, which for children is 12 months and for adults right now is 6 months. That may all change. But what typically happens is patients and parents don't always really understand which plan would be best for them within 30 days. By the time they fill out the application, find out they were accepted to the plan, they try to figure out a plan, and then they call their doctor that they've had for the last 5 years, and they don't take that particular plan, then they're unable to switch. So the first part of this bill allows them then to switch once during the year. The other part of the bill specifies that if a large group of providers, primary care providers, changes their contract status with plans and more than 500 enrollees are affected, that those enrollees would be moved to the other health plan in a opt-out fashion. So the enrollee would be notified, ask if you don't want to move to the other plan, let us know, rather than the current way of which I've had personal experience with, the opt-in fashion, which patients don't understand. It's complicated. They think they're losing their benefits. There might be a reason they don't want to go to another plan. So those are the main two parts of the bill. I think it is important with medical home and continuity of care that we preserve the primary care relationship. It's important for cost, outcomes, and all the other reasons that I'm sure all of you are aware of. I have numerous examples with children having this disrupted. I think really we just want to make sure that for all members on the Oregon Health Plan that they have existing primary care relationships that are working for them, that they can maintain those when they're enrolled. And I think with the economy and the change in the past year, that has really come to light a lot because people had a different insurance. Now they're on an Oregon health plan, and they really did not understand our delivery system of multiple managed care plans and what their choices would be.
So, thank you. Senator Bates, would you like to testify next? Are you on a short schedule?
I thought it meant.
Yeah, I'm kind of in another committee right now.
Okay, please.
I'll give you a quick testimony. Hi, Doctor. For the committee, Alan Bates, State Senator, District 3, and I did not know you were hearing the bill right now. Thank you for your administrator bringing me down here real quickly. I'll tell you quickly what sort of generated this and what the bill is trying to resolve. We had a situation last summer in which a large number of patients were going to be moved, and that move was a result of a change in a group of physicians changing from one insurance company to another inside OHP. And it kind of boiled down to, is the patient's relationship with the provider or is the patient relationship with the insurance company? And I came down the side, it's with the provider. And that's the most important relationship there. Now, there's some nuances to this. Sometimes you try to move a family, because these were primary pediatricians this time, then the receiving insurer has to agree that they will honor the contracts that the previous insurer had, not only with the group moving, but with ancillary providers, such as any specialist that a child might have been involved with, or if the family was moving, that they would be able to see their primary care physician also. That was actually an agreement that was reached during this, but it took weeks and I think maybe even months before we got through it all. We ended up transferring patients one by one. I think some of that's still going on now. It hasn't quite completed itself. Well, we needed a mechanism for doing this quickly and easily. OHA didn't really have a way of doing it. Plans were uncertain how to do it. It really became confusing, and the people who lost out here primarily were the patients. They became very confused about what they were supposed to do, who they were enrolled with, who their primary was going to be, do they have to change relationships. Ultimately, in the end, I think most of it got taken care of, but we would like not to have this happen again, and we may see more of this with transformation coming on. We may see plans changing around the state. Some plans may come together, some plans may go away, and we don't want patients left hanging, so to speak, wondering what's going on as far as who their provider is, whether it be a pediatrician or a family practitioner. And some of them may be lined up because of some special medical reasons with certain specialists as essentially their primary care provider. So we don't want those issues happening again. This bill, we believe, resolves that issue and gives a clear path for everyone to move forward when there's large changes and movements of individuals as insurer changes. Does that sum it up pretty well?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Now, I would be glad to take questions from the committee other than from Representative Greenlee.
Sorry, we're stuck with what we have.
Because he asks questions I usually can't answer.
He always gets the first question or the last question or both.
I'll take the last.
Representative Greenlee.
I will try to answer questions if I can.
I admitted how confused I was a few minutes ago.
So. Yeah, good.
As you pointed out, it's not entirely true.
He always starts out that way, and you find yourself slipping into a trap.
Getting worse. You really stated the principle, and that's in an insurance environment where physicians have patients and insurance companies have
lives,
clients and members, whatever the term is, you argued that the physicians own the patients.
No, I don't. They don't own them. They have the primary relationship.
The primary relationship.
Yeah, they don't
know. So should we just amend this bill and make it mandatory for any health insurance circumstance that when a provider doesn't want to contract with an insurance group, they can take their patients to another, leave Blue Cross and take their patients to Providence?
It would be something to consider at a later time. The difference here is we are the payer in this situation. The state's the payer, so we have more of a controlled situation. We're moving patients amongst insurers, which we actually are the payer for. The question you're answering is a good one. As an example, a few years ago, about on an annual basis, I would have patients that would come to my practice because their insurance had changed. They didn't want to leave the previous physician, and they transfer their records to me, and the patients would come over, be reestablished as new patients. Take a lot of time to do that. The next year, their company would then buy the old insurance company back again, and we move all everything back again. This went on for about 4 or 5 years of moving these patients back and forth, and some of them got hurt by it. It's hard to keep track of a patient really carefully when they're moving to a different primary every single year or every other year as the insurance paid. So your question, I believe, is should we require that to be the situation in all cases? I don't think we're quite there yet, but it's an interesting concept and one we probably need to explore at a later time. I agree. Same problem, it's just a different population of people.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else? Why was the number set at 500 instead of 45 or 200? Or what's magic about 500?
I believe when we talked about this that there are very few plans that had less than 500 individuals in that category. We felt that was probably a number that would work at.
Okay.
You could argue it should have been 450 or 0 or 1,000. We thought that was probably a pretty reasonable number.
Complaints always come back when that number doesn't work, so I was getting ready for that.
Give us something to do in February, sir.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, co-chairs. I appreciate the time, and I'm sorry I didn't prepare myself better. I was kind of surprised to come down here, but if I helped you, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming and getting me.
Yeah,
thanks.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you're next.
Okay. All right, Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, member representatives of the committee. My name is Charlene Matthew. I'm a pediatrician in Southeast Portland. I actually am a constituent of Co-Vice Chair Cannon's. If my name, funny spelling of my name seems familiar to you, if you've ever wandered over into Senate chambers, my last name is up on the wall there in the front. I married into Oregon history. My husband's great-great-grandfather was F.X. Matthew. But I'm here today to kind of give the personal side of why I think this bill is important. And as Senator Bates and Dr. Burdeen already alluded to, it really comes down to continuity of care. And as a physician, my relationship with my patients and my knowledge of their history. And I could give you countless stories of why that is important. And I'll just give you a few. I'll try to limit myself. And you can certainly argue that the same is true for private insurances, and that certainly is a problem, as Senator Bates detailed. But I think what we're talking about today are some of our most vulnerable patients, and that's where I have seen some of the biggest differences come to light. One example is a patient of mine. Santina's 8 years old, and I've been seeing her since she was 2. And prior to that, her main health care was in emergency rooms. She's a very bright young lady with some emotional and physical chronic problems, and a mother who is developmentally delayed. And over the years, I have been able, through repeated visits and through my knowledge of Santina and her mother and extended family members, I've been able to, I believe, change a lot of her outcomes. I've been able to keep her out of the emergency room for the last probably 4 years now. And to me, that's a real victory. I think I've made Santina's life better. We've gotten her asthma under control and some other issues under control, and we've saved a lot of money in the process. And there have been times where her plan and my plan might not have been the same, and I would just hate to have lost the progress that we've already made. I continue to see her today. The other problem is that, as Dr. Burdeen stated, it's very difficult for a lot of these families to understand the process, especially when they're enrolling in the Oregon Health Plan. And over the last year or two, we've seen a lot more children being enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan, and that's been a big difficulty. And where all of a sudden, parents are so relieved that they have health coverage, and then they realize they can't go see their doctor. Another patient that I have are brothers Nicholas and Lucas, and I've been following them since they were born. And they have real rivet parents. You know, now we're not even talking about real vulnerable families, but we're talking about hardworking parents. The father's a construction worker. The mother works on a website and giving talks to other mothers about how to save money and cut costs in the home. I mean, they're really active, proactive people who lost their insurance. The mother became pregnant and she qualified for insurance, and then about 3 months later her husband got laid off, and so she enrolled her sons in the Oregon Health Plan, and she'd been waiting for a while for them to come in and have their checkup, so she fortunately called right away, and that's when she realized that she wasn't on the same plan that I was, but she was in that 30-day window, and she was able to change, but it took walking down to the local office and being told she had to do it by phone, and so dragging her two kids and her pregnant self back home and calling and being told, no, you have to go back down and do that in person, and she went back down and did it in person, and then she got switched to a totally different plan that neither I or her gynecologist was on, and then she called again and it got fixed again.
I ask you to wrap it up pretty quickly.
Yes.
We've got a couple more bills we have to hear before 5.
Certainly. This is somebody who's on it and with it and still encountered multiple problems, and there was a delay in care, and finally things got sorted out the day before she delivered her third child. So just to wrap up, you know, if people can have some more time, I think that will help us be able to take better care of our patients and continue seeing them if they have time to figure out which plan they should be on. Thank you.
Thank you. Judy.
For the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the Director of Medical Assistance Programs with the Oregon Health Authority. And in the interest of time, since you already have a written testimony, I will just go over what I was going to say very, very briefly and call your attention to actually the last section here. But first of all, I just wanted to let you know that we have worked with the sponsors of the bill and are in agreement with what is here in the bill, and are quite willing to work on this and implement it. The only issue that we would want to call attention to is that it becomes effective upon passage, and we would need to develop some rule and some contract changes that would need to be reviewed by CMS, and so perhaps as practicable by upon federal approval, if that could be considered, we would be appreciative. Otherwise, we will work with the bill as is.
Thank you. Okay, and with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 201A. Okay, we have two more bills we need to have open public hearings on between now and 5, because we have to be in another committee at 5 o'clock. So I'm going to ask you to kind of be concise so we can get these moved through here, if you would. And first up is, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 86A. And first up will be Anthony Behrens.
We'll get Senator Cruz.
And Lester Bascom, and we'll save the third seat for the moment for Senator Cruz. And would you please start your testimony when you're ready?
Certainly. Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony Behrens. I'm a senior policy analyst with the State of Oregon Insurance Division, Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'll try to be very brief. I'm here today to talk to you about Senate Bill 86A regarding medical retainer practices. There are a couple of physicians in the room that I think can better explain what these types of practices are, so I'll leave those the details of the practices to them, given the interest of time. However, I'm happy to answer any questions on that particular aspect of this issue that you would like. The issue of medical retainer practices came to the attention of the department a few years ago. Since then, a number of providers have contacted us with questions and concerns about whether or not, if they had started such practice, it would violate the insurance code. Because providers who operate retainer practices are accepting a risk in exchange for providing a benefit, some of these practices may be considered insurance and may be subject to the requirements of the insurance code. However, applying the insurance code to retainer medical practices would likely, as a practical matter, result in the elimination of an industry that appears to be providing useful benefits to consumers. On the other hand, we do have some concerns that consumers may confuse retainer medical practices with insurance and not understand what it exactly it is that they are buying. Although we are not aware of the number of retainer medical practices in the state, the increasing number of inquiries the department has received would suggest that the number of practices is increasing. Senate Bill 86 is the department's proposal to address this emerging issue by exempting retainer medical practices from the insurance code so long as the practice is certified by the department and meets certain standards to ensure that patients are protected. These standards include the following: the practice is limited to primary care, it prominently discloses to prospective patients the specific services offered by the practice, that it may not use or disseminate any marketing, advertising, promotional, or sales material that are false, deceptive, or misleading, and it may not be controlled by an insurance company, and it may not bill insurers or other third-party payers for services that are covered by the agreement. As we worked with a number of stakeholders on this legislation, our goal was to provide the best of both worlds, protecting consumers by requiring clear disclosure of the nature of the agreement between the provider and the patient, and limiting the risk borne by the providers to a manageable level, while at the same time allowing a business model that appears to benefit consumers who may not otherwise have access to health care. I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'm willing to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chairman and committee members, my name is Lester Baskin, and I'm a direct practice internal medicine physician in Portland. I've been in practice for 13 years, and I've seen a steady erosion of my specialty over this time. Internists are really considered the bedrock of healthcare throughout the industrialized world. Numerous studies, like the summary press release that I've included with my paperwork today, put to the systematic importance of a dedicated, reliable primary care physician. However, in the United States, this specialty is really dying. In a 2007 survey of U.S. medical students published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, only 2% of respondents indicated plans to specialize in primary care. And by 2020, the American Association of Medical Colleges predicts that there will be 45,000 too few primary care physicians. Even our own OHSU, which is widely considered one of the crown jewels of primary care training in the United States, in some recent years has produced only a handful of primary care internists. Last year in 2010, out of 30-plus graduates, they graduated two into primary care. Everyone else went into higher-paying specialties. Reasons for the low rates of primary care graduates include the need for higher reimbursement to offset large educational debt, the perceived low status and satisfaction of internists relative to other specialties, and increased paperwork. If you were to poll most physicians, they would say the same things about their profession. They like the intellectual and technical challenges of medicine. They want to form lasting relationships with patients, and they prefer not to be burdened with paperwork. Few of these criteria are being adequately met in the conventional insurance-based model. Direct practices, however, offer a compelling alternative to the high overhead and low efficiency of conventional care. Direct practices are prospectively paid and have much smaller patient loads. This allows primary care providers to offer same-day service, remote access for their patients, and this creates a natural preference for primary care over specialty care, which is generally agreed to reduce costs. After all, if you can reach a regular doctor by email or phone, why go to a specialist? Prospective payment frees the physician from what I refer to as the tyranny of the office visit. We've heard a lot of presenters today talk about the benefit of telemedicine, the benefit of remote access. Direct practices are really at the forefront of this model. Right now, it's very difficult, as you've already heard today, to get reimbursed for anything other than an in-person office contact, although there are changes underway on this issue. However, as a result, most doctors don't offer these modes of communication, which really creates a highly inefficient service model. In my practice, and most direct practices, probably 65 to 75% of care is delivered remotely, saving obvious time for the patient and quite frankly, for the physician. With a smaller panel of patients, it's easier to deliver care where and when it is needed for whatever duration the patient requires. It's really only through the commitment to spending time with patients that doctors can get to know their clients and in turn understand their problems and diagnose their illnesses. Today's fast-paced medical system simply does not allow this outside of a direct practice setting. Patient and physician satisfaction is very high in this model. My annual turnover is less than 5%, which is typical for direct practices, and this compares quite favorably to conventional practices where turnover is often as high as 20%. The proposed legislation, SB 86, clarifies what services a direct practice can offer and reassures physicians that they won't be running afoul of state insurance law should they choose this model. For this reason, I support Senate Bill 86, and I look forward to working with the department on any amendments. Most health services experts agree that primary care holds the keys to a more efficient delivery model. Direct practice offers a compelling alternative to the inefficiencies of insurance-based care models, while also improving access and patient satisfaction and raising interest amongst current and future medical trainees in the field of primary care. After all, as my wife, who's also an internist at OHSU, and I often bemoan, given the current medical graduate trends, who's going to take care of us when we're old? Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Cruz, we were waiting for your words of wisdom, but you couldn't be found. So, but now that you are found,
I'm
welcome.
Found. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. When we heard this bill in the Senate committee, we found it very exciting on a couple levels. Number one, we think that this practice maybe something that we can discover in the future, maybe part of healthcare transformation when we get to the global budget and all those things, and we're not dealing just with Medicaid. This may be a very good way to deliver primary care. The previous speaker talked about some amendments. The one issue we had on the Senate side was the issue of dental practices, so we have intentionally excluded them from this bill, so this is only dealing with medical practices. One of the things we discovered we needed to find out, number one, was how many of these sorts of organizations do we have in the state, and how can we ensure that patients and providers will both know that there's a clear, bright line between this sort of practice and the traditional insurance model of care, and which is the main reason that the insurance division brought this bill forward, and I think this bill does allow us to make that clear, bright line. But what really excited us, quite honestly, Mr. Chair, was the fact that this is kind of old school medicine in a way, and I think something that could be very positive. When I look at healthcare transformation, big picture down the road a ways, to be able to potentially go to primary care and a non-insurance model in this more efficient way of service delivery excites me, and it's something that I think needs to be explored. And we're counting on the insurance division to help us further define what this is and what it is not, and this bill will allow that to happen. I think this bill was never considered to be part of healthcare transformation, but at the end of the day, as we move forward with whatever we come up with, we may find that this is a key component, and we need the definition, and we need to know what sort of practices are out there, and we need to have the clear, bright lines so that providers who want to move into this sort of practice can do it with a level of certainty. This, I personally think this is very exciting, and I urge support of the bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Dan Greenlick.
May I ask Dr. Baskin a question or two?
You can ask all the questions you want.
Careful. Sir, what do you promise your patients? What do you tell them they get for whatever you charge them?
What most patients are attracted to in my practice is the access. It's the email and phone access, and the fact that I care for my own patients in the hospital, which almost no one does anymore, even direct practices.
But I was asking, what do you say to them? I mean, you say to them, you pay me some amount per month, is that, or per year or something?
Yeah.
What do they get back? What's the promise you make to them in return for them giving you some money?
So I offer longer appointments than a typical, you know, a typical primary care physician. So my standard office visit is half an hour. Physical exams are an hour. I see my patients same day, which many conventional practices can promise. Am I answering your question or not?
Not quite. Do you promise to see them for the money? I mean, I'm trying to understand what your practice is. You say you give me $150 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can come to me whenever you need me, and I'll
correct.
I'll deliver the service to you that you need.
Correct.
And as I remember correctly, you used to be a part of Kaiser Permanente.
Correct.
How is that different from what Kaiser Permanente promises, at least in terms of the primary care piece of what they promise?
It's very similar.
But they're regulated. Are they regulated to a certain extent?
Right. I'm sorry, Kaiser?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. The difference is that I'm carving out one small aspect of the entire, you know, care universe. So whereas Kaiser is taking risk for heart transplants, bypass surgeries, cancer care, you know, I'm promising to provide services for a very, very small portion of the total healthcare dollar.
So if a group of physicians that provided the whole spectrum got together and said, okay, you pay us $400 a month, and you can come to any one of our doctors and we'll provide you all that service, that would be the same as this, or would that be Kaiser?
Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, this bill is limited to only primary care services, so in that way the bill limits the scope of the risk that the provider bears. So if you had a group of physicians that were going to provide more specialty services, more complicated services, like the heart transplant, that type of thing, they would not qualify for this.
So if 100 primary care physicians got together and offered this to 10,000 people, that they would deliver primary care, and they had 10,000 people now, they would still be exempt under this from your service?
Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlink, they would be exempt if they met the requirements of the bill, and the risk and the services they provided, they were reasonably capable of providing the services that they are promised to provide. So if they could provide those services to that many people, then, I mean, obviously there are a lot of variables. Theoretically, then they could qualify for this registration, assuming they met the other requirements.
If I may, just a little bit more.
Sure.
Health insurance is you pay you money, your house burned down, we'll give you $100,000. But in health insurance, we move to what's known as a service model, where we don't provide any reimbursement to you. We just say, okay, if you need the care that's in this contract, we'll arrange for you to get that care. So, I mean, it was when we switched from the indemnity model to the service model, we did exactly what Dr. Baskin is doing, writ large. How unlarge does it have to get in order for you to stop regulating it in the same way that you regulate Kaiser, which doesn't promise to pay any amount of money? All Kaiser promises to do is to provide care when you need it. Primary care? They may not do it as good as as Dr. Baskin's doing, but he did it pretty well when he was with Kaiser. But it sounds to me in concept like it's exactly the same thing. So, I mean, I wonder why couldn't Kaiser come in and say, okay, let's get a bill that exempts us in the same way Dr. Bascom is exempted from your regulation, because we just provide service. That's all we promise to do.
Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlick, I think you raise an excellent point in that these practices under current law may be considered insurance, and that's one of the reasons that we brought this bill forward, is because as a practical matter, physicians like Dr. Baskin could not comply with the insurance code and maintain this type of practice. The burdens are just too onerous. So essentially, to some degree, to a great degree, it's a policy call for the legislature to determine whether or not they want to allow this limited exemption under the insurance code. The reason Kaiser couldn't do it or any other insurer could not do it is because the bill specifically prohibits insurers and those controlled by insurers from qualifying for this exemption.
What's an insurer?
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Sorry, I think that we have enough today to...
Okay, we have four people on the panel who want to ask questions, and will you keep it kind of short, because we have three more people to testify. So we'll start off with Mr. Kennever.
Thank you. Dr. Baskin, I guess, what kind of charges do you have, and do you sign contracts with your patients? How do you manage the scope of what you offer?
Co-Vice Chair Kinnemer, I sign contracts with each individual that joins my practice, and much in the way that the legislation asks physicians to clarify, you know, what the scope of services are and what the patient and provider responsibilities are, my contract essentially already offers. So it explains that you know, the service they'll provide is the service that they will receive is only service from me, that there are certain things that I don't provide, that they still need their own health insurance for things that I don't provide. It's fairly clearly spelled out.
And it's a standard fee? Do you have different levels, or
Fees in direct practices are sometimes set on the basis of age. That's usually, you know, how they're set. So, for example, you know, under 40 may pay one fee, over 40 may pay another fee.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'd be interested in seeing these kinds of documents. I think contracts are an important piece of a business model, and I'd like to understand what they are and how comprehensive they are and what kind of fees they command. That would be my request.
Is that something you'd be willing to share?
I'm sorry?
Is that something you'd be willing to share?
Oh, certainly.
Just whatever document, if I called and said I want to be your patient, what would I get? What would you tell me?
So a typical packet includes variety of federal forms that you have to fill out, HIPAA releases and that sort of thing, as well as a contract.
Okay, thanks. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I actually like the concept of what you're doing. I think, you know, once upon a time in our country, you know, you could, like, go swap out something with your doctor and get the kind of care that you wanted and needed. And quite frankly, I know doctors who do this. I know nutritionists who do this, swap out housekeeping in exchange for services or what have you. So I'm all for this. I'm also dropped the amendment to this because I also don't think you should have to register with anybody if you want to do it, but that's me not liking hoops to business. I'm assuming, though, that you, like, didn't draft this from, like, elawyer.com. You probably worked with somebody, a lawyer, to help you draft your contracts, and that your contracts are legal and binding, and if you don't provide what you say you're going to do, we have contract law that protects your patients. Can you speak to that?
Representative Parrish, that's correct. So I worked with a healthcare attorney here in town in Portland to help me develop the contract, and I also relied on other providers who are in similar practices.
Thank you.
Representative Whitehair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, Dr. Baskins, what you're doing, I think, is actually great. I see this expanding more than what's happening here, so I'd hate to see us focus on Dr. Baskin's practice, because
this opens up other opportunities for businesses and for doctors to provide health care. I see basic health care for people who can't afford buying the Cadillac version of a health insurance plan, but that way an ear infection doesn't turn into something severe where they end up in the emergency room where they can go see a doctor for a less amount. So, or employer can provide something for them. So I could see possibly an employer carrying a higher deductible for his employees and using somebody like Dr. Baskins to insure for just the basic coverage. And that way, if they have something major, then they go to the hospital. If they have something minor, they go to Dr. Baskins. And I don't know if that was your concept when you were putting this together or not, but I think it's a great thing that you're doing here.
Representative Hoyle.
I testified on this bill in the Senate committee to talk about a pilot that we had in Lane County specifically before this bill was passed, and we worked with DCBS because, as I've said before, Lane County has one of the highest uninsured rates in the state. 21% of people in Lane County are uninsured, and when they open this up, and for its Cascade Health Solutions, their program is that people pay $45 a month and then $20 a visit, and for extra family members, it's an extra $40 a month. 68% of the people that came had hypertension or were diabetic or pre-diabetic but hadn't had access to primary care. And it was an affordable way for people to access primary care, but the reason that it was important for DCBS to be involved, and Teresa Miller worked with us to make sure that that this company was able to treat consumers well, is that consumers, when they're paying a monthly fee and seeing doctors, assume that it's insurance. So we, that company and my office and Teresa Miller worked to make sure that there was full disclosure to consumers, so they knew that if they went in and got tested for, say, a lump in the breast, that the treatment for that breast cancer or the specialist treatment was actually not covered. And so that is a real critical piece. And that, why, that I think that's why it's important that DCBS be involved, because by getting people access to affordable primary care, we keep them healthier. But we also have to make sure that consumers understand that they're not insured for these much higher risk healthcare problems. And I think this is a great program. I think this is a great bill. And it has made, I mean, I think that we've got about 1,000 people that are enrolled in this program now, people that did not have access to primary care. So it's been great.
Be quick.
May I add a comment? So, Representative Hoyle, I think your comment is very interesting because it's one of the gaps that direct practices hope to fill. You know, in this country, if you do not have insurance, you have two options, urgent care or the emergency room. And so it's an interesting idea that, you know, there might be entire groups of employers who might not be able to afford a traditional indemnity plan at, you know, $300 or $400 per person per month, but might be willing to provide their employees some basic minimum level of primary care as opposed to, you know, leaving them up to, you know, up to either fending for themselves or, you know, utilizing emergency rooms or urgent care.
And just to speak to that, we have a number of people that work in agriculture that are migrant farm workers. We have people, we've reached out to people within the restaurant industry and also corner stores, Dairy Mart, and we're worked in partnership with Dairy Mart to get low-wage workers access to primary health care that they wouldn't have otherwise. It's been tremendously successful.
But in that plan, for every 1,000 people, they're getting $500,000 a year. And the notion is that's not an insurance plan that they're enrolled in. Seems very odd to me. I mean, that company's collecting $500,000 a year, and it isn't going to be there to provide services when somebody needs it.
But they do provide a service that is needed to help. I mean, we do have to figure out how to fill in the gap. And in Lane County, we have a number of different programs that work with people that are low income and uninsured to be able to find access to a higher level of care. But our real gap is allowing people who don't have insurance, who are low to middle income, to have access to the basic primary care and public health and wellness to keep them from going to the ER or the urgent care. Again, chronic disease management has been a real critical piece for nearly 70% of the population that has sought this particular organization out. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but it's either that or nothing. So it's a it's difficult.
And Co-Chair Greenlich, if I might add, so to put in perspective for the committee, you know, the piece of the healthcare pie that we're talking about, you know, your question earlier, you know, how is my practice different from a Kaiser? A typical indemnity plan devotes, whether you're talking about ODS or Providence or Kaiser or Blue Cross, typically devotes between $20 and $25 per member per month to primary care. So that's on a typical, you know, indemnity monthly fee, a typical premium of between $300, we'll say, and $400. We're talking about carving out less than 10% of the healthcare budget, if you will, looking at it from an insurance premium standpoint. So the risk and the total dollar amount in a practice like mine is minuscule compared to the risk and the dollars at stake in a Kaiser or a Blue Cross or an ODS or a company that's offering much more comprehensive service.
And $25 a month is about what you charge?
$25 a month is what a lot of practices charge. It's not what my practice charges, but it's what a lot of practices charge.
Do most practices deal with low-income people? Is that what they're designed for?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I know that there are a tremendous range of offerings, you know, throughout the country. You know, at least what I read in the newspapers, there are practices serving, you know, low-income individuals, upper-income individuals. It's a very flexible plan because, again, it tremendously reduces the cost of service. So, you know, my office, for example, I have one employee. My next-door neighbor, who's on an insurance, you know, an insurance-based conventional model, he has three employees. You know, his overhead is 50%. My overhead is 20%.
Mr. Chair,
what my intention is here at the moment, we're running the clock down, and a couple of us have to be in another room at 5. So I'm going to give you 30 seconds, you a real fast question. Then we're going to close down this public hearing and reopen it on Friday to complete...
Wednesday
to complete okay. The testimony.
If I could, Mr. Chair.
Please.
You need to understand the reason these direct practices need to be certified is for the protection of both the provider and the patient, so that we have a level of certainty as to what is insurance and what is not, and the parameters will be set. The providers are assuming risk. And for the money that they take in, for that money, they provide the services. And for some patients, you know, it's a capitated system. For some patients, they never show up. Some show up all the time. That's the risk model. But it's inside this very small window here. But they do need to be registered so that there is certainty both for the provider perspective and for the patient perspective. This is a good model that we need to do a lot more exploring. And I would suggest, committee, don't get too down into the weeds on the way this doctor practices or not. Rather stay with the concept.
Okay. My apologies to John Saltz, Paul Newman, and Chris Allman, and Terry Bunker. I understand we have on the phone today. We will reconvene this hearing on Wednesday. We're up against a hard 5 o'clock here for another committee, so we're very interested in what you have to say, just not today. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 86A with the intent to reopen on Wednesday.
Did you announce that we're carrying over 86 too? 89.
Also, we're carrying over Senate Bill 89A to Wednesday. And with that, we are adjourned.
Hey, I still have a minute. I got jumped.